Well, good morning, everyone. It's 10 o'clock, so we'll make a start on this compulsory acquisition hearing, which is part of the examination of the application for a development consent order to construct and operate the proposed extension to Tilbury Docks by the applicant Port of Tilbury London Limited. Excuse me. The title given by the applicant to the application is Tilbury 2. I do appreciate quite a few of you were here yesterday, but I need to go through the same basic preamble because these hearings are all standalone, and the recording needs to reflect that fact. So introductions first of all. I'm the chair of the examining authority panel. My name's Dr. Michael Ebert. And I've been appointed by the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government to be the lead member of this panel. And it comprises three inspectors here at the table who will examine, report upon and make a recommendation to another Secretary of State, the Secretary of State for Transport, on the application by the Port of Tilbury for the development consent order. I'm a Chartered Civil Engineer, a member of the Institution of Civil Engineers, and I've worked at the Centre of Government for decades, actually. And I've also been an examining authority for a number of nationally significant infrastructure projects. And my two colleagues, I'll let them introduce themselves. Paul Hudson has stepped in the last month to replace Dr. Lillian Harrison, who was the chair of the panel until then. She had to resign because of personal reasons. Paul Hudson.
Good morning, Paul Hudson, examining inspector.
And on my left, Max Wiltshire.
Good morning, I'm Max Wiltshire. I'm a chartered civil engineer and a member of the Institution of Civil Engineers, and I've worked with a range of organisations delivering infrastructure projects.
Thank you very much. Many of you will also recognise on my far right there, Robert Ranger, the case manager for the Planning Inspectorate for Tilbury 2, who's here today to ensure the smooth and efficient running of the hearing. Assisted at the back there by Dean Alford. And they're your reference points, really, in terms of anything that you may need today. Robert is your ongoing reference point for anything to do with the project for the examination on an ongoing basis. I'll hand over to Rob to take us through the housekeeping.
Thank you. Could we first of all please switch our mobile phones off? If the fire alarms sound, please follow the exit signs and assemble in the car park. Please don't go home so that we can check that everyone's accounted for. There are no alarm tests scheduled, so if the alarms do sound, it's for real. Microphones should be used by everyone who wishes to speak so that your contributions can be heard on the recording that's being made of the proceedings. Dean has a roving microphone that will be brought to you if you're not sitting at the table and you wish to speak. An induction loop's available for those who benefit from its use. Toilets are available just outside the door of the hearing to your left and right. Coffees and refreshments have been kindly provided by the applicant at the back of the hearing room. That's everything.
Thanks very much, Robert. And let's see who we've got in the room then today. Let's go around the table first of all, starting with the applicant.
So, good morning. I am Robbie Owen, speaking today on behalf of the applicant.
Matthew Fox, speaking on behalf of the applicant, Vincent Masons.
Judith Pike, Walker Morris, speaking on behalf of the applicant.
Good morning, John Speakman, Port of Tilbury.
Ian Wright, Port of Tilbury.
Elsdon, Port of Tilbury.
Okay.
Paul Harwood,
Paul Mayall, partner at Eversheds LLP on behalf of RWE Generation.
Peter Cole from Strutton Parker, speaking on behalf of the Cole family and Mr. Tony Gothard.
Okay.
Helena Payne, PLA.
Alison Gall of Winkworth Sherwood representing the PLA.
Alex Dillastone, Winkworth Sherwood representing the PLA.
Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else in the room who's proposing to speak today? You won't necessarily, in fact, you won't at all be barred from speaking later if you don't announce yourself now, but if you are proposing to speak, it would be useful to hear who you are and who you represent. No? Okay. Well, thank you all very much. just a few other things. This session is due to run from 10 till 1, and we'll have a coffee break at roughly 11:30, according to how things pan out on the agenda. If we need a second session after lunch, that will run from 2 till 5, and an audio recording is being made of this hearing, as it is with all hearings, and will be placed on the Tilbury 2 section of the National Infrastructure page of the Planning Inspectorate's website. If you wish to speak, all you need to do is raise your hand and we'll spot you and invite you in as appropriate. Can I also inquire if there are any journalists in the room? No? Okay. And can I also inquire whether anybody intends to record, tweet or film these proceedings for their own use? No? Okay. Right. It's worth saying, by the way, you do have the right to report, film and tweet these proceedings. However, you do need to do it responsibly and in a way that does not interrupt the proceedings in any way. You also need to bear in mind any possible desire by individuals that they are not filmed. Also worth bearing in mind that the only official record of these proceedings is the audio recording that will be placed on the PIN's website. Tweets, blogs and similar communications arising from the meeting will not be accepted as evidence in the examination of this application. If you want to know the principles on which we're examining the application, I'd refer you to the recording of the preliminary meeting, which is on the 20th of February this year, and again that's on the Planning Inspectorate's website under the Tilbury 2 heading. In brief though, there are six principles that we're working to, which are independence and impartiality, rigour, a focus on evidence and justification, openness, fairness and timeliness. Now in regard to timeliness, that latter point, we are roughly 2 months into the examination, which started the day after the preliminary meeting, 21st of February. So roughly 2 months in, and we are under a statutory obligation to complete within 6 months. We can complete earlier if we the panel, feel we've got everything we need to write our report and recommendation to the Secretary of State. We then have a maximum of 3 months to produce that report, and the Secretary of State then has, in theory, a maximum of a further 3 months to make his or her decision. Well, there's often a certain amount of flexibility in the Secretary of State's 3 months. Okay, so that's the timetable. That's where we are. We do intend, as we'll say at the end, we do intend to hold a further series of hearings in June. And the rest of the timetable is in what we call the Rule 8 letter, which we issued on the 26th of February, if you want to see the full timetable. So now on to the agenda for today. And I think without further ado, I'll hand over to my colleague Paul Hudson to lead us through it. Paul.
Thank you, and good morning again. You have an agenda of 15 or 16 points which we've produced in advance to guide us through the discussion. Could I start really with a few sort of processy type questions, 1, 2, and 3, before getting on to specific land interests as they relate to the order? So, I mean, essentially, I think these are just to help a bit of understanding on our part. I mean, the first one, I hope you're going to be able to produce an update of the land tracker in due course, perhaps by deadline 3.
Robbie Owens, good morning. yes, we certainly will be able to. I also, at some stage today, now or later, if you wanted us to just give you a verbal update on where we have got to with the various land acquisition negotiations, then we can do that. I'm conscious, for example, that we don't have specifically on the agenda any reference to the land that the port is proposing to acquire from the Coles family, Mr. Gotthard, and Thurrock Council. So we had those noted as areas you might in particular want to have an update from us on at some stage.
Well, I think in that regard, it's the very last question. We'll cover the...
Yes, OK, we can cover it then, yeah. It's certainly in relation to the Coles family, yeah. Yeah.
OK, so you're going to provide an update to the land tracker for deadline three?
We will, yes.
OK. Question then, 3.3.2. I appreciate that the range of circumstances are set out in paragraph 3.15 of the Statement of Reasons, but as a relative newcomer to the order, I'd find it very helpful if you could just provide a table that sets out the plots to which the various subsections of Article 27 apply. I mean, it looks as though there's a fair amount of crossover between various subsections.
Robbie Owen?
Yep.
Not really, sir. I mean, essentially, Article 27 is in two parts. First, paragraph 1 of Article 27 provides that all private rights over land that has been compulsorily acquired under the order are extinguished. So that applies to all land that is coloured pink on the land plans, to the extent that land does need to be compulsorily acquired if and when the order is made. And that is a standard provision, as indeed is paragraph 2 of Article 27, which says that in relation to all land in relation to which rights are acquired or covenants are imposed, then again, private rights that are inconsistent with those interests are extinguished. And again, that therefore applies to all land coloured yellow on the land plans to the extent that the order powers in relation to that land need to be exercised, as opposed to matters being done voluntarily. So we can provide a table, but it would in effect be a table listing all the land coloured pink in relation to paragraph 1 on the land plans and all the land coloured yellow on the land plans in relation to paragraph 2.
Well, looking back at the statement of reasons, I mean, what about land which is in the port's ownership, which is not then subject to CA or temporary possession?
Well, that wouldn't. This article wouldn't apply because the land is not subject to compulsory acquisition.
Well, that's really why I was a bit puzzled by the description in the statement of reasons, which indicates that Article 27 does apply to land already in the port's ownership.
Yes, I see why there might be some misunderstanding there. The intention is certainly not to... if you may be thinking of RWE's interests, as we've confirmed to RWE, the intention is not to obtain DCO powers in relation to RWE's rights and interests that would allow them to be in effect extinguished. In essence, the regime that's been negotiated between the port and RWE in relation to acquisition of the former power station land, yeah, that position is intended to remain, and we're not intending to be seeking DCO powers to override that.
I take it then that Article 27 applies to the land which is coloured green in the land plans. Sorry,
yes, that's right.
This particular provision of Article 27 applies to land in the port's ownership, which I guess is that coloured green.
That's right, sir, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why I then came back to it being helpful if you could, say, just produce a table which shows which plots, which parts of Article 7 are intended to apply to, and indeed those plots which are not named in the order, land in your ownership, to which part of Article 27 does apply.
So we can certainly provide a table if that would help. Yeah.
Well, I think it would help me.
Yeah.
Make sure I understand it.
Yeah. That's fine.
All right. Thank you. And then, thirdly, again, this is just looking at the very large number of interests which Category 3 of the Book of Reference applies to. I mean, if you could just provide me with a plan that just shows the boundary. I mean, I appreciate it's described quite clearly in the statement of reasons, the area to which Category 3 interests apply. But if you could just give me a map that shows the boundary, it would be appreciated. And tot up how many Category 3 interests there are.
So we can certainly do that for Deadline 3.
Thank you.
The information I have is that there are 3,552 interests, all of which are included in Part 2B of the Book of Reference.
Okay. Good. Well, that's half of the question answered, so that's easy. Good. Okay. Now, moving on then to question 3-4. You set out in the statement of reasons, I think in Section 8 and indeed Appendix D, the number of statutory undertaker interests. And at that stage, I think it was fairly preliminary in the negotiation process. So I think it'd be helpful if you could just tell us where you are with the range of SU interests involved.
So the general position is that negotiations are ongoing with all of the Section 127 and 138 parties identified in the statement of reasons. And the parties who have submitted relevant representations and written representations are, as you all know, Network Rail, the Port of London Authority, Anglian Water, National Grid, Electricity, and Cadent. And detailed discussions are ongoing with all of those parties. Section 127 is relevant to, we think, three of those: Network Rail, PLA, and Anglian Water. So far as Network Rail is concerned, I refer you to our response to their written representation. The port doesn't consider that any of the land that is owned by Network Rail, which is proposed to be acquired, is operational railway land, except for plot 02002/03, and that's the plot required to allow the Tilbury 2 railway spur to connect to the main line. So discussions with Net Rail are ongoing. I don't believe they're represented here today. We've made good progress on the terms of the protected provisions, I've no reason to believe why we shouldn't be able to conclude those successfully with a bit more time, well before the end of the examination. So the Port of London Authority, I mentioned them earlier. In fact, on the basis that our understanding is that the PLA has not submitted an objection on the basis that the acquisition of their riverbed would cause a serious detriment to their undertaking, we don't think Section 127 applies. That said, NEDAC would be discussing various occasions this morning that we are in detailed discussions with the PLA. including in relation to a proposed lease of the riverbed on which the jetty currently stands and over which the extended jetty will stand. Again, we're confident that we will be able to successfully conclude those negotiations such that the compulsory acquisition powers would not need to be exercised in relation to the PLA's interests. So we don't think, as a matter of technically, Section 127 applies, given the terms of the PLA's objection. If they think otherwise, no doubt they'll say so. But that's where we are with the PLA generally. And equally with Anglian Water, who I mentioned earlier, they too have not submitted an objection on the basis that the acquisition of their land and the extinguishment of their rights that is proposed. That's the jetty and the pipe at plot 0401. Again, they haven't said that that would cause a serious detriment to their undertaking. So again, we don't believe Section 127 applies. I should go on to add that discussions with Anglian Water are well advanced, and we fully anticipate concluding those successfully, leading to the acquisition of the jetty by the port. And as you'll be aware, the jetty is proposed to be demolished as part of the scheme as provided for by Schedule 1 to the DCO. So that I think deals with Section 127, sir. Section 138 applies to the rest of the statutory undertakers listed in Appendix F to the Statement of Reasons. Appendix F to the first written question. I think Cadent and National Grid clearly have said that acquisition would result in a serious detriment to their undertaking. We are in advanced discussion with Cadent and National Grid, and the issues remaining are very narrow. So I think, in summary, sir, we feel we're making very good progress with all of the statutory undertakers, and we would very much expect to be in a position by the end of the examination, if not sometime before then, when those issues have been satisfactorily resolved, such that the statutory provisions aren't engaged.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that probably deals with question 3.8, in one fell swoop. I'll ask PLA if they've got any comments on the position as you outline it, but I don't think there's anything else in relation to the representations which have been made from Network Rail, Cadent Gas, National Grid. So I think we can agree that we've dealt with 3.8 as well. Okay. PLA, do you want to comment? Thank you.
Yes, we are having fruitful discussions with Tilbury. We're sure we will come to an agreement. We haven't quite got there yet, but I don't think we need to trouble you further this morning.
Good. Thank you very much. Any other comments from any other parties on the statutory undertaker proposals? No. The next item, 3.5, I think this is just an update point. Looking at the statement of reasons, I think paragraph 319 sort of tails off incomplete, as indeed just the way this question's phrased, rereading it. There should be a should in there somewhere. But am I correct that what's missing is really just a reference to the rights point?
Robbie Owen, so you are correct. Yep. There is a very small error here. Well, there are two errors. First of all, the is it forward-facing slash at the end of paragraph 319 of the statement of reasons should be a full stop, not a forward-facing slash. And the reference in the first sentence to land shaded blue should be a reference to the land shaded yellow.
Yep.
And therefore that, in effect, refers to the plots that the agenda item mentioned.
Okay.
So we will correct that at an appropriate opportunity.
Good.
Thank you. Then, quite recently, you've removed plot 0305 from the order. And it would be helpful just to sort of understand how that circumstances has come about.
Robbie Owen, certainly, yes, we removed plot 03/05 from the land plans at deadline 2. This was one of the plots that it was proposed that the port would take temporary possession of, and it's currently referred to in Schedule 6, the DCO, in the entry there, two-thirds way down the page, referring to temporary possession of land to provide a construction site compound, diversion of utilities, and ecological restoration. We have, as a result of representations made by interested parties, particularly Natural England, had another look at the requirements in that area for construction working space. And Mr. Ian Wright from the port, who introduced himself earlier, if I could just bring him in to ask him to explain how come that can now be, as is the proposal, released from the scope of the order. Mr. Wright.
Good morning, Ian Wright, Port of Tilbury. The measures needed to manage the strata of the grazing marsh during its temporary occupation and restoration works and post-management on reflection outweighs the benefit for any temporary works benefit for the project.
Well, I mean, you'd identified it as being used for a temporary construction compound, so presumably the need for that facility is elsewhere on the site, is it?
Yeah, we do feel we've got other areas where we can put temporary compounds and lay down areas for contractor areas elsewhere.
Okay. I mean, does that then alter the description of land parcels elsewhere in the order?
So if I can perhaps come back, I think we would in taking plot 03/05 out of schedule 6 by just deleting that entry, we've of course already at deadline 2 put in a replacement land plan that doesn't show that entry, so there's just a missing number in the series, really, which we would say is of no consequence. I don't know if that's your question. Or
It was rather more if you're providing for the temporary construction site somewhere else, is it on one of the land parcels which is included in the order, for which the description of the use to which the land is being put would need to be just brought up to date?
So my understanding, I think Mr. Wright can perhaps confirm this, is that we were talking earlier about the land coloured green on the land plans. That is the land that the port already owns.
Okay.
And my understanding is that this re-evaluation that's been carried out in the light of Natural England's objection has meant that we think there's room on the green land for the additional construction working space. Is that right, Mr. Wright?
Yeah, as Mr. Owen alludes, we're looking to utilise the green area for contractor compound laydown areas for temporary works.
Okay, thank you. Well, that was really just the point. So, I mean, it is a straightforward removal of the parcel and the description in the order. Okay, thank you. Question 3.7. Just so we can be reassured about the financial strength of the applicant when it comes to meeting compensation claims, the statement of financing sets out that you will be ring-fencing the funds necessary to meet the total cost of compulsory acquisition. But it would be helpful to know how you intend to do so, and really what what degree of comfort we can look to for that purpose.
Sir, thank you, Robbie Owen. I'll try and give you that degree of comfort. As outlined in the funding statement, Port of Tilbury London Limited is a wholly owned subsidiary of Forth Ports Limited. These are, of course, well-established and substantial companies in their own right. They were both incorporated as companies in 1991, at the time of the transfer schemes made under the Ports Act of that year. But, of course, the underlying port undertakings existed well before then, and in the case of Tilbury, the docks were part of the Port of London Authority's undertaking, had been for many years previously, and in the case of Forth Ports Limited, it was the Forth Ports Authority before Forth Ports Limited. The Forth Ports Group as a whole generates substantial revenue from both its statutory activities and also its commercial activities, and is adequately funded to meet the costs of compulsory acquisition should the powers be granted, and then should they need to be exercised. Generally, in relation to its business, you won't be surprised to hear that the group and its directors manage the business so that adequate financial resources are maintained at all times to meet obligations as they fall due. The finances of the business are tightly managed by the directors through a number of internal control procedures, budgeting and planning systems, and really, as with any other liabilities, funds allocated to meet the liability of compulsory acquisition will be managed and maintained so that the funds are available to meet the liabilities when they fall due. So we see the same good practice procedures and systems being utilised in relation to exercising the compulsory acquisition powers of the order as in relation to the group's business as a whole. And if the powers in the DCO for compulsory acquisition are included in the DCO, if it's made, then the amount of money I'm instructed that is required to meet the related obligations to pay compensation, that amount of money will be accrued for in the accounts of Port of Tilbury London Limited, and it'll only be released once the compulsory acquisition powers have been exercised and all resulting compensation payments made, or in the event that the necessary interests in and rights over land concerned are actually acquired by the port without having to use those powers, then again the funds will be released for accounting purposes at that stage, because there won't be a need to make use of the order's compulsory acquisition powers. Because, of course, it is important to remember that even if the DCO powers include compulsory acquisition powers, the port, as is good practice for all acquiring authorities, will try to obtain the land that it needs and the interest in land that it needs and rights in land that it needs voluntarily, as opposed to exercising compulsory powers. That's what I can say in terms of how the sort of you put it, ring fencing. I referred to accruals in accordance with the port's normal business practice of making sure that it can meet its obligations.
Yeah. I mean, I don't doubt the financial strength of the port from what is said in the funding statement and indeed the accounts which I think you've supplied subsequently. But I think it is the simple point that the port is now a private company, and in being asked to agree the proposition for compulsory acquisition, just being absolutely clear that the funds are available come what may to meet any liabilities. I could well appreciate also that in the context of the total costs of undertaking the scheme, the CA obligations are fairly modest. But nonetheless, I mean, these are other interests which are being looked at here, which probably need to be reassured that, say, come what may, the funds would be made available.
Well, Indeed, sir. I mean, I, from my position, which I appreciate is not the same as the port's position, given I'm just an advisor, but I can give that reassurance. And Mr. Speakman, on behalf of the port, is halfway down the table on my left here, and is responsible for the property acquisition element of the project. So, Mr. Speakman, are you able to sort of provide the reassurance that Mr. Hudson is looking for?
Speakman, Port of Tilbury. I would reiterate the comments that my colleague Robbie Owen has made, that we are a substantial company. You have acknowledged that the compulsory acquisition is a relatively modest part of our project. We certainly will have the finances available on the basis of being a substantial company. You know, we would like to give you that assurance that we will be able to meet those obligations.
Okay. I still think what is missing here is some identifiable sort of mechanism that demonstrates that the estimated total sums are, as it says in the statement, in the funding statement, are ring-fenced, and being able to demonstrate that they're ring-fenced in some way in the accounts or through a bond or whatever, I think is the sort of standard way of just demonstrating that a private organisation in seeking compulsory acquisition powers is fully able to meet those obligations which arise. But I think I can only just leave the point with you.
Sir, should we reflect on it and see what more we can provide? It may be, for example, that the finance director is able to write to you to confirm that this will happen. Would that be helpful?
Well, I've raised the point, as I say. I think in terms of being able to suggest to the Secretary of State that there's no risk that the port, if granted these powers, could not meet the obligations, the more you can do to just put that beyond doubt, okay. I think the easier things will be.
Yes, I would take Robbie Owen's point, and we'll speak to our finance director to give some response at the next deadline.
Yes.
Good. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. I think we've agreed that question 3.8 we've already covered off. Can I then turn to question 3.9, which is one specifically relating to the ASDA roundabout. I mean, I appreciate discussions between Highways England and the port as the applicant. I mean, are still ongoing. But my query is really, if the design for works to the ASDA roundabout are not yet agreed, and you might end up with a set of proposals which are somewhat different from those in the order at present, you might need a different arrangement for land acquisition or temporary use of land that the order currently provides for. And if that circumstance arises, how are you going to, deal with it?
So I think, Robbie Owen, the extent of temporary possession powers provided for by the order, that's been, you can see from sheet one of the land plans, the blue area, which is the area over which temporary possession could be taken, not only includes the roundabout itself, but each of the four arms of the roundabout, together with some of the length of road approaching the roundabout. And the intention has been to set those limits broadly enough to be able to accommodate the detailed design as and when that emerges and has been agreed. Certainly we're not aware of any discussions with stakeholders that would suggest that more land than that is shown is currently required. The other thing I should say is that, of course, it's not just temporary land that would be required to implement the finally agreed design for the roundabout improvement works, but of course there is a collection of other order powers
that are not similarly constrained to the blue land that are phrased flexibly. So, for example, the powers in relation to street works and the powers in relation to traffic regulation measures, those powers are not framed with reference to the temporary land. They're more broadly cast than that, just so, for this very reason, really, that and this is, again, standard practice, as you'll probably be aware, just so we can make sure the powers are broad enough to reflect and implement the finally agreed scheme once that is agreed with Highways England.
Okay. Mr. Harwood, do you have any view on this, notwithstanding your ongoing discussions?
Paul Harwood, Highways England. Yes, sir. For a start, can I say that Highways England does not believe the temporary use powers sought for plots 01 to 07 are necessary? And generally, we do not agree with the applicant's proposals for carrying out works on the SRN. However, if those compulsory powers were considered to be necessary, we suggest the current proposed extent may not be sufficient. We suggest that the powers must be applied not only to the permanent works, but also to any temporary works, such as contraflow crossovers, that may be required to construct the permanent works. Similarly, they must apply to any other mitigation work on the SRN that might be required by the proposed development. Compulsory purchase is not something that can be left to protective provisions. If temporary use powers are necessary, the applicant must design the permanent and temporary components of Work 11 and any other mitigation work on the SRN to a level of detail such that the necessary and sufficient areas required to construct both permanent and temporary works are identified. These areas should then be incorporated into the draft development consent order.
Okay, I mean, we are talking here just about temporary possession in terms of these plots on the land plans. This is not compulsory acquisition, this is just temporary possession.
Well, it is rights over land, sir, that are sought. As I say, we do not understand why those powers are needed, and we invite the applicant to explain that. But
yes, yep.
if they consider the rights are needed, then we think they are probably not sufficient.
Okay. I mean, my So the point was really, if you, as a result of these negotiations with Highways England, come up with a different scheme, are you satisfied that you can contain those alterations within the proposed powers that the order provides for?
Robbie Owen, sir, we are, yes.
Okay.
We are satisfied, and we will. Have been reflecting on these issues from yesterday and are intending to include in our deadline three submissions sort of further illustrations to sort of demonstrate that, really, and we can provide an accompanying note that sort of sets out that it's not just the order's temporary possession provisions, and you're right, they're not compulsory purchase provisions at all, as I say, it's the collection of the other order powers. For example, Article 8, I didn't mention earlier but could have done, contains extensive powers. Again, very standard practice in relation to street works. It's entirely appropriate for the applicant to be seeking these powers over the SRN so it can implement the scheme. That's the whole purpose of the DCO, as you'll be aware. So Highways England is just not correct about that, but we will continue our discussions with them to hopefully reach agreement.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure we can take that particular point a great deal further forward.
No.
At this stage. Thank you. The question about Anglian Water and its jetty, I think I probably understand the position. When drafting these questions, it wasn't entirely clear to me what their position is, but the fact they have made no formal objection. Sorry about that. It's all very musical, isn't it? The fact they've made no objection, and I think you've explained the nature of the land acquisition proposals, indicates to me that there is no issue as far as Anglian Water is concerned. You will no doubt confirm that to be the case from your perspective, but
yeah, Robbie Owen, I mean, absolutely, sir, I can, and clearly they wouldn't be contemplating selling it if it was required for the recycling,
yep,
for the water recycling centre. Mr. Speakman has been heavily involved in these discussions. I mean, that's your understanding, isn't it?
Sir John Speakman, Port of Tilbury. No, that's absolutely our discussion with Anglian Water. It's not required for the future, and you're right. They wouldn't be talking to us about acquisition of the jetty if it was.
Okay. Thank you. Question 311. I mean, Historic England are not here, but I couldn't quite understand from their submission how it squared up with the stated purposes relating to these two plots. So I sort of look to you to confirm that what you say is correct and the way Historic England have characterised this is perhaps incorrect.
So, I mean, hopefully we can clarify this. In the plots 0308 and 0310 are proposed for compulsory acquisition, but in accordance with Article 32, it may be that the port first needs to temporarily occupy the land before acquisition for the purposes of building the scheme. And we had previously suggested that plot 0305, may be used for construction purposes, but as we've just heard, that's been removed from the scope of the order. So that's really, I think, all I can usefully say. I don't know if Mr. Fox wants to add to that, but that's our understanding.
I would just add, from Matthew Fox, behalf of the applicant, just to reflect what Mr. Wright said earlier, paragraph 5.104 of the ES in the errata version does specifically state that the construction compound will be on the Tilbury 2 site. Because I understand from Historic England that was what they were concerned about where the compound would be.
But that's not the stated purpose for the use of these two plots in the statement of reasons. So
exactly. So to be clear, the construction compound will be on the Tilbury 2 site, the green land, so not 308 and 310, which are for cost acquisition and specific uses.
Okay.
It was Mr. Owen's point was that under Article 32, we might first utilise the temporary possession powers before then compulsory acquiring. But that's just in terms of the land transactions and how you manage taking going onto the land.
But Historic England have no interest in these two plots.
No. I think they were just concerned about where the compound was going to be. And as you identified earlier, 305 had identified
Would
be there, but that's now removed.
Right. Okay, thank you. Moving on then to RWE's interests. I mean, this also relates to question 14.1 that we had on the very first day, covering the same sort of matters. And I think we've received a representation from RWE that you are willing to provide us with a plan that shows the range of interests that you think you have on the Tilbury 2 site. Thank you very much. There is then the sort of broader question about how you think those interests are intended to be safeguarded if the order moves forward, which is really the subject of other questions. I think it's clear that there are no compulsory acquisition proposals intended, but nonetheless there is a residual query about how other bits of the order might sort of impinge upon your existing rights. And so as set out in the question here, it looks as though sort of Article 28 is currently drafted, although I appreciate the applicant has recognised there's probably an error, which might be the source of the difficulty, which, if corrected, would apply Article 28 only to the order land and not to all the land within the order limits. But nonetheless, so just looking at plot 606/10, for example, for which compulsory acquisition is intended, that does seem to cut across RWE's interests in its entirety. Now, shall I ask the applicant to explain first, and then RWE, you can respond.
So I think, if I can, firstly, there are, as we sort of discovered earlier in relation to Article 27, there are a couple of references to, in Article 27 and Article 28, which, as you know, are articles dealing with overriding private rights over land. There are references there to the order limits, and those should be references to the order land. Yep. Therefore, that correction will be made and would exclude the green land over which RWE does have all sorts of proprietary rights as agreed on the sale of the former power station land to the port. In relation to 06.10, so that's the first point. Second point, in relation to 06.10, essentially the jetty, RWE has a number of contractual rights and entitlements, given that there is some apparatus that was not part of the sale to the port. There are some apparatus on and under the jetty, which it needs to get access to. Essentially, these are the two B station, Tilbury B station, cold water intake pipes that I think you probably saw on your site visit or saw some of the infrastructure for. So they go from halfway down the eastern arm of the jetty diagonally in a sort of 1 o'clock direction to RWE's retained land, and therefore those structures are obviously under the riverbed and they come up underneath the jetty, and whilst the jetty is now owned wholly by the port, there are some contractual rights that were reserved from that sale of the jetty in favour of RWE, and the intention is not to, in building the scheme and extending and modifying the jetty, not to clearly take away those contractual rights and entitlements. There may be some temporary effect on them, and that is something that is being discussed with RWE, and the intention is it would be a position that would be regulated by a legal agreement. And because they, because those contractual rights and entitlements of RWE are not proprietary interests, they're not interest in or rights over land, then that is why we've dealt with them as we have in the documentation for the application. I should also go on to say, and this is really the third point, that in the same way, in building out the scheme, whilst we aren't seeking any form of compulsory acquisition powers in relation to the main site that could have any effect on RWE's retained interests, clearly in building the scheme there may be some temporary interference with them. So for example, one of the principal retained interests when the power station site was sold to the port lies in relation to the access road. RWE retain an easement in essence over the access road from the main entrance, and of course in building the scheme there will need to be some degree of temporary interference with that that easement and the enjoyment of it. So again, it's intended to be temporary, and that's something that we are also in discussion with RWE over in terms of regulating the use of the order's powers in terms of how that interference might take place and when and for how long, all those sort of things. So that is how we essentially see things.
Okay, thank you.
Stop. Thank you, sir. Paul Mann on behalf of RWE. RW obviously set out its concerns in relation to the various rights that it enjoys in its deadline one submission, and have reviewed what the applicant has said deadline two and discussed this morning. Obviously, it welcomes the clarification that there's no intention to acquire or extinguish those rights, and agrees that there needs to be various amendments to the DCO in order to give effect to that. So insofar as commenting on those amendments, we'll reserve our position until we see them in the revised DCO submitted at the next deadline. In terms of the specific plot that's been referred to this morning, 610, I think RWE's position in terms of whether the nature of their ride is something that should be included within the book of reference, I'd probably raise the question in a slightly different way, that in the absence of any agreement, and I reiterate what Mr. Owen said, that the applicant and RWE are engaged in trying to reach an agreement to deal with these matters, but in the absence of an agreement, is the powers that the port seeking to rely on to undertake the works that it needs on Plot 610 authorised by these compulsory purchase articles? And if they are authorised by these compulsory purchase articles, then the nature of RWE's right is something that should be reflected in the book of reference, would be RWE's position. As I say, discussions are ongoing, and it's hoped that we can resolve these issues in the not too distant future.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think you have sort of underlined the point of the question, really, because it did seem to me that you are proposing compulsory acquisition of Plot 06/10, and therefore that would carry with it all the rights and obligations that the plot contains. And unless there's some mechanism for continuing those rights out with the order, well, then they must be swept aside.
As part of the overall discussions between PLA and Tilbury, and indeed RW are involved as well, there is the question of how to regulate these pipes. And yes, you're absolutely right. The property rights are one way of going about it. Another is to take account of the licensing regime and deal with them in that way. Now, how one balances the two is a matter that's being discussed and I think that the discussions are probably likely to become tripartite in the near future. And a resolution will be found. Quite what the amendments may be and how they're reflected in the order or outside the order is what is being discussed at the moment.
Okay.
Robbie Owen, thank you, Mrs. Gorlov. That's helpful. Sir, as I said earlier, the main purpose of, the purpose of seeking compulsory acquisition powers in relation to Plot 0610 and the adjacent plots was because at the time of the application being submitted, the port had not been able to reach an agreement with the PLA for the necessary property rights for the scheme. Those discussions are continuing, and the expectation is that, as I said earlier, they will conclude satisfactorily, and therefore the port will not need to exercise those compulsory purchase powers.
Okay. So I think then the sort of main issue revolves around the range of RWE's interests on the main Tilbury 2 site, which is in your ownership, and say for which there are no compulsory acquisition or temporary use provisions. But I think it comes back to our discussion about Article 27, which again, if I understand it correctly, provides for the port to exercise rights over land in its ownership, and where those are third party rights, you will remove them. So unless there's some other mechanism that enables RWE's interest to be safeguarded, it looks to me as though Article 27 sort of gives you those powers unequivocally.
So if I can try and summarise the position in this way. First, the intention was not that Article 27 or indeed 28 should apply to the Greenland.
Ah, but I think it does. That was a discussion we had at the beginning.
I know, and I think we have said to RWE that that is a drafting error in terms of the reference being to order limits, whereas it should be to order land. So we will correct that, and that will deal, I think, with a lot of these issues. Secondly, there is the, as I said, a proposed legal agreement that sets out how, in building the scheme, we will be able to interfere with, if I can put it that way, RWE's both property rights and also contractual rights in relation to the jetty. And the third aspect, as Mrs. Gorlov has mentioned, is that we are in discussion further about Article 3.1 of the order and how to deal with it was 3.2 and 3.3 really in relation to the existing structures in the river and how we deal with them going forward. In terms of their licensing and general sort of legitimisation, if I can put it that way. So I guess that there are those sort of three areas that we are looking at progressing, which I think together will hopefully deal with these issues.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So without sort of going back over old ground again, if in producing the table that I asked you to provide, sort of dealing with the plots to which Article 27 applies, if you can also produce a note which explains how paragraph 315 of the Statement of Reasons is to be amended, because I think it is quite inconsistent now with the way in which you understand the article to operate and the land to which it applies. So I think it would, at a stroke, then sort of remove some of these difficulties.
So certainly, we will do that. Yeah,
okay,
no problem.
Thank you. Is there anything else that RWB want to add? Then, I mean, if you're in discussion and you think you're both able to resolve this, then we'll happily leave the matter there.
Paul Mayall, on behalf of RWB, yes, sir. Okay. We are in discussion. Nothing further to add at this point. Thanks.
Thank you. Question 314. Then, we've touched on this on several occasions. That as the applicant, you are in discussions with the PLA about. How to move forward, which would obviate the use of compulsory acquisition and TP powers. If you get to that point, though, how will the order actually need to change?
So again, Robbie Owen, this is something that we haven't come to a concluded view on, but certainly the discussions that have been taking place so far with the PLA have been that once agreement is reached, we would bring forward an amendment to Article 23 to exclude the PLA's interests from the parcels concerned. So the exclusion would only relate to the PLA's interests in the land concerned. We would still wish to retain the power to compulsory acquire any other interests. Now, we currently aren't aware of any, but there is always the prospect of there being unknown parties, despite full investigation of title, which of course has been done as part of this whole exercise. So that is the current view. We're still discussing it with the PLA, but that is what I can say for the moment, I think.
Okay. So, I mean, from a practical point of view, in the way the land plans are shown, you wouldn't expect to see any removal of plots. It's
no.
Really the description of land interests that accompany them. That
well, it's
would
really it's really as is often done, sir. It's really providing for an additional paragraph in Article 23,
yeah.
Saying that despite what Article 23 says, it can't be used to acquire any interest owned by the PLA.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. PLA, you can agreeable to that?
Yes. Good. Isn't
Thank
it?
You.
Good. Item 315, we've heard nothing from the Crown Estate. Do you have anything to add to how your discussions are going with them over these two plots?
So what I can say, the Crown Estate obviously isn't here today, but they've indicated to the port that the Crown Estate is generally supportive of the scheme and the inclusion of the relevant land within the DCO. We've agreed in principle that the Crown Estate will grant the port a lease of the riverbed, which, as you may remember, is plot 0602, owned by the Crown Estate. And once the negotiations with the PLA have progressed a little bit further, we will be in a position to, in effect, replicate the lease terms with the Crown Estate. That's what's been agreed. In effect, the Crown Estate has said, well, we expect we will be happy with the lease on materially the same terms as the lease to the PLA. And therefore, that's what's been agreed, and that's the understanding. And we're clearly aware of the need to produce their consent for you in accordance with the Planning Act. Hopefully before the end of the examination.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then finally, we'll broaden out this last question to embrace not just the sort of coal family interest in three plots, but also the Gotthard interest, which I think you're representing. Do you want to just advise us how far you've got, Mr. Owen, with these two sets of negotiations?
Certainly can, and Mr. Speakman can sort of chip in if I get this wrong. But certainly in relation to the coal family, first of all, documentation to acquire the necessary land and lease the temporary land is well progressed with the family, and we do anticipate that the outstanding issues, there are some complexities, as you appreciate, will be resolved, and therefore the contracts can be exchanged within the next few weeks, and levels of compensation have been settled, so the commercial arrangement's been reached. So what is now taking the time is dealing with the more technical issues, and certainly in terms of title to the coal family interest, that's now been fully investigated and resolved and is pending registration at the land registry. So that is essentially where we've got to, and there are two main documents being progressed. One is an option to acquire the permanent land take, so the pink parcel concerned, and secondly, a lease of the land where temporary possession is proposed. So I don't know if Mr. Cole is able to comment on that, but that is my understanding and where we've got to with negotiations, so far as the coals are concerned. Shall I carry on with the other interests first?
Yes, the other three interests for Mr. Gotthard.
In relation to Mr. Gotthard, negotiations are continuing. They're not quite as advanced, I think it's fair to say, as with the coals, and a further offer was sent to Mr. Gotthard's representatives on the 16th of April, to which a response is awaited. And then I should also perhaps at this stage, because it's all to do with the replacement common land in relation to Thurrock, you of course remember that the council is the owner of the proposed exchange land.
So this is plot 0304A.
That's right, sir, yes. Again, discussions with the council are proceeding, and we've had now the independent valuer's report, and we're, we're hopeful that we can make some further progress shortly. So I think probably the Coles is the most advanced, Mr. Gotthard's negotiations next, and then Thurrock is the final one. Mr. Speaker, in particular relation to Thurrock, are you able to sort of say anything more?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Owen. John Speakman, Port of Tilbury. So, we have, as Mr. Owen mentioned, received the independent valuers report from the council. We have been in discussion with the council for approximately a year. That report came in to us earlier this year. We have exchanged correspondence and put a counter offer to the council, and I met this week the council's head of property to discuss that, and we await from Thurrock Council their counter offer.
Okay, thank you.
Finally, if I can perhaps also deal with the Common Land Conservators letter.
Okay,
you may recall 4th of January they they wrote, to which the port has responded, again actually towards the end of January, setting out the position that we consider that the replacement common land does meet all the requirements for replacement for exchange land. We are sort of trying to progress those discussions to ensure that the Conservators are content with where we've got to. We are still awaiting response from the Conservators and need to hold another meeting with them. But we have made some progress since we last updated you on that.
Okay, thank you. So you are willing to essentially meet there. Their suggestions in terms of access and other matters?
Not entirely. We did sort of put to them sort of some counter thoughts. I haven't actually got the letter in front of me, but I don't know if Mr. Speakman can recall the detail, but they were asking for some fencing, which we thought wasn't required.
Mr. Owen, thank you. Sirs, John Speakman, Port of Tilbury. That's really part of the purpose for wanting to meet the Conservators again to discuss the detail of those proposals.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Cole, you want to...
Yes, thank you. Peter Cole from Stratton Parker. Just for the record, although I'm speaking for the Cole family and Mr. Gotthard, I am in no relation to one of the clients. And I agree with Mr. Owen's comments with regards to the Cole family. Discussions are ongoing and progressing. In principle, we have agreed all the terms for the granting of an option to allow the Port of Tilbury to acquire the common land. The agreed terms, as we've discussed, as involved, was the relocation of part of the common land that is proposed to be permanently taken. I would have hoped to report to you today that we would have looked to start to arrange signatures, but as Mr. Owen has mentioned, there has been some amendments. I've spoken to the Cole family solicitor last night, and we're just now finalising a few terms, but in principle, things are progressing. With regards to Mr. Gotthard, I think it would be sensible to just approach the panel and set the scene for them, how discussions are progressing. Mr. Gotthard owns this industrial property, which extends to approximately 0.97 acres, which will be affected, obviously, by the proposed Port of Tilbury 2. Within the perimeter fence, there's a number of buildings used as workshops and storage for plant and machinery, a small site office, along with staff rest areas and other required welfare facilities. The remainder of the site is open storage, along with a telecoms mast in one corner, which Mr. Gotthard rents to Vodafone. The industrial yard is occupied by Mr. Gotthard's established business, Gotthard's Landscape and Land Reclamation Limited, which also has other sites within the area. There are two full-time workers that are based at the yard. Mr. Gotthard manages the yard from his offices just north of the railway station. And we would like to make the panel aware of the likely loss of employment and industrial business use following the compulsory purchase of the industrial yard. Just furthermore, I just want to touch on how where discussions are going with the valuation side of it, and we don't believe that the Port of Tilbury have correctly approached the methodology of valuation to compulsory purchase and have not offered the appropriate compensation for the direct and indirect impact on Mr. Gothard's existing business. As a result, we are having ongoing negotiations with the Port of Tilbury to provide them with the consent to equally have an option to acquire Mr. Gothard's yard. It is clear that Mr. Gothard's yard is unique and there is not a similar and suitable alternative site available for the sums offered by the Port of Tilbury in the Tilbury area. I should note that our client was offered an alternative property by the Port of Tilbury within the existing port boundary, but following the inspection and discussion with Mr. Gothard, it was not deemed suitable and the offer has been declined. Just touching on the offer which was put forward on the 16th of April, we have not had time yet to review that and we will revert back.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, I think the position is clearly understood. I take it, just as a general point, that if you are successful in concluding voluntary land purchase arrangements, that you will nonetheless continue to maintain the compulsory acquisition and indeed temporary possession powers as shown in the land plans, just in terms of any rights that might continue to exist. I mean, sometimes applicants remove plots because they've been able to acquire the land and that sort of deals satisfaction with the issue. But as far as, well, just you tell me what your intentions are.
Robbie Owen, certainly so as things currently stand, that would be our intention to maintain the powers, okay. which is also fairly common practice, yes, as you'll appreciate.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. I think that deals with all the questions that we've raised as agenda items. Are there any other matters that the applicant or indeed any other participants wish to raise in relation to compulsory acquisition and temporary possession matters at this stage? No? Okay. Thank you. I'll hand back to you.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. just noting the time, 11:17. What I would suggest is we take a break at this point for maybe 20 minutes and then come back for a wash and brush up session on 3 days, focusing really on what we as a panel are expecting as we go forward and what the applicant in particular is expecting to deliver at deadline 3, the next deadline. And we'll probably need that 20 minutes just to finalise any such lists that we may already have produced. Does that make sense from the panel's point of view?
Sure.
Yep. And from the applicant's point of view, does that make sense to you? 20-minute break?
Robbie Owen, yes, sir, and I have a spreadsheet here that it might be helpful for us to run through that we've been noting what we've been promising for deadline 3, and hopefully it aligns with your own.
So we'll do that after a break, shall we?
Thank you, sir, yes.
20-minute break, then. Let's say it's 11:20, roughly. You come back at 11:40. Right, well, welcome back, everyone. So we're now in a wash and brush up session out there following the 3 days. We'll start with items that we, the panel, would like to see for deadline 3, and then we'll invite the applicant to go through your list, and then we'll go through some items in relation to the timetable, just to confirm how we're proposing to run the remaining stages of the examination. So the items that we need as a panel for deadline 3 are these, and 9 of these. The first is the development consent obligation, section 106 agreement, with clarity on who would be party to it. Second item on our list here is the high-level cumulative effects assessment, including the Tilbury Energy Centre and the Lower Thames Crossing. The third item is a paper on the site mitigation and off-site compensation, and associated with that, the updated ecological mitigation and compensation plan.
What do you mean by a paper on, given the potential, when you say paper, do you mean the different documents, or, because we've got the EMCP, which is supposed to be the off-site, and the on-site.
Sorry, can you say again?
So it was just because you said kind of two things which are around the same point. You said a paper on...
The ecological mitigation paper may well contain the thing that I've just alluded to, the on-site mitigation and the off-site compensation. If it's in that one document, that's fine.
Robbie Owens, can I suggest that perhaps what you might find helpful is an introductory sort of update as where we've got to with the whole ecological mitigation, both on and off-site, and if appropriate, appending an update of the EMCP.
That's exactly the point. Yes. Fourth item is a paper on the approach to the works on the strategic road network, expanding really on the explanatory memorandum where that's concerned. Item five is reasoning and assumptions on traffic modelling. Item six is the revised draft development consent order itself. Item seven, an updated land tracker. Item eight, updated statements of common ground. And item nine is an updated habitats regulations assessment. So those are our nine principal items. We're well aware that you also said you would produce other ones, so let's hear what your list looks like.
Robbie Owen, thank you, sir. Just on that last item, you mentioned earlier, of course, the updated cumulative effects assessment for both the Tilbury Energy Centre and the Lower Thames Crossing. And as I mentioned on Wednesday, that would include dealing with cumulative effects on European sites and protected species. I think in relation to updating the HRA itself, which of course is a separate document, we have been thinking ourselves that given that we need further discussions with Natural England in relation to the additional birds data that we discussed yesterday, or was it Wednesday? I can't remember now. And also their thoughts on additional mitigation measures. That might be something that we're not going to be able to achieve until deadline four. It would still be before second written questions and the next round of hearings. So that was what I was going to suggest that to you in terms of deadline four, not deadline three, for the updated habitat regulations assessment. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Well, I mean, plainly, it's better to have it complete rather than sort of work in progress. The issue, I think, is that, as I stated when we were discussing that item, given Natural England's position, we will be producing a RESA report on implications for European sites, and the updated HRA report will naturally need to feed into that. Our timetable for producing the RIS is the 13th of July, so I think at sort of first blush, a suggestion that the HRA report is produced deadline four looks as though it would fit in with that with that timetable. While I'm talking, could I also just draw your attention to we were made aware yesterday of a recent European Court judgment, which you might want to, well, we would encourage you to take account of in producing the updated HRA report. The case is case number is C-323/17, and was I think the judgment was handed down on the 12th of April, and the implication is that it effectively overturns the accepted UK practice of considering mitigation at the screening stage of HRA in determining whether appropriate assessment is required. Now, I think the sort of consequences of that are yet to sort of settle down, but it looks rather likely that full appropriate assessments will be required rather more widely for a wider range of projects. All I would do is just encourage you to look at that judgment and to see if there are any implications for the way in which you, say, conclude the revised HRA, and we can then sort of proceed accordingly.
Robbie Owen, so you may be relieved to hear that we were aware of that.
Wonderful.
Maybe saddened to hear, but anyway, we were aware of it, and that is something we will take account of in the course of revising the HRA. Yeah,
that's very okay. Helpful. Thank you.
So there were a few other items, if I can just list those.
Yes, please do.
In addition to I think it would be a second revision of the DCO, the first revision being the one that was put in a deadline one. So in addition to the second revision of the DCO, there will be an explanatory note. I should add that we're not going to be able, by deadline three, to deal with all of the revisions that are required of the DCO, not least because we won't by then have concluded discussions with the PLA. I can say that because we have a meeting scheduled for the 3rd of May, for example. So we will deal in the revision two with those changes, for example, the ones that come out of today affecting RWE. There won't be that many of them, I anticipate. There will be more in revision three coming later, but we'll keep the process going by putting in a revision two as you've requested.
Thank you very much.
We are intending to put in a second version of the planning policy compliance statement, which is one of the application documents just dealing with the proposed changes to the national planning policy framework that the government is consulting on, and they are clearly important and relevant matters for the purposes of your consideration of the application under section 104, we would suggest, so we think you would find it helpful to have an updated planning policy compliance statement dealing with those proposed changes to the national planning policy framework.
Mm-hmm.
We will be submitting a second version of the proposed skills and employment strategy. That is intended to be an appendix to the what we've been calling the Section 106 agreement. And that's to reflect discussions with stakeholders and hearing yesterday.
Yep, good.
Then there are a number of documents that are proposed to be secured by requirement that we think need updating, again, to reflect discussions with stakeholders and these hearings. The first of those is a further version of the framework travel plan.
Mm-hmm.
The second is changes to the sustainable distribution plan. The third are changes to the terrestrial archaeological written scheme investigation. And the fourth, this will be secured by the demarine license as opposed to a requirement, but changes to the marine archaeological written scheme of investigation. We're also intending, following points made this week, to bring forward an amended version of the construction environmental management plan, dealing with the references to should, for example, that came up this week, and cross-references to the ecological mitigation and compensation plan. And also, Mr. Fox reminds me, dealing with the fort monitoring, section 10.2. Next, one of the appendices to the construction environmental management plan, you'll remember, is a construction traffic management plan. And again, to reflect discussions with stakeholders, we intend to bring forward some changes to that document. And I should clarify that all these new documents will be produced in clean and tracked versions, as we've been doing to date. You mentioned earlier the modelling note required in relation to the traffic assumptions and traffic issues. As I mentioned earlier, we also intend to bring forward a note demonstrating how we believe the mitigation works required to the Asda roundabout can be implemented in the way that the order has been drafted, given the flexibility of the powers sought. That'll be a note with probably some illustrative drawings. Next, there's the piling note I mentioned on Tuesday. Then there's a note on filming at the fort that Mr. Ward promised you. Mm-hmm. Then there's, we think it'd be helpful, following discussions yesterday, to give you a short note in terms of the river flood wall and the how construction of the scheme wouldn't affect the condition of that wall, apart from obviously the bit that needs to be changed to accommodate the physical scheme itself for the link span. And then just a few other things. There's the Category 3 map that we've mentioned today. There's the Article 27 table that Mr. Hudson requested, plus dealing with reconciling that with Section 315 of the Statement of Reasons. There's the further assurance that we've been asked to provide on funding. There will be, obviously, post-hearing submissions for each of these three hearings, and we will append to the appropriate one the press release and memorandum of understanding that Mr. Ward mentioned in relation to the London Resort scheme. And I think, finally, if the above haven't dealt with everything, we may have to respond to some of the deadline 2 comments submitted by interested parties, as the Rule 8 letter anticipates. I believe that's everything from our side. So nothing in addition to that. So I hope that's helpful.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very useful. We'll look forward to receiving all of those. The nine areas, documents that we highlighted, just to give you an idea of the things that we, at this stage of the examination, regard as of particular significance to us. But we certainly welcome all those other items as well, because we do recognise they're also important. So thank you very much for that. In terms of the points about responses, or post-hearing submissions, that obviously applies to all parties who've spoken. We certainly welcome written notes of your submissions at these hearings, so we can have the record of those. So thank you very much for those. I'll just go through the timetable, or the points that were left in some areas open in the timetable. So we can confirm that we'll be producing, that we'll be issuing second written questions, and that we'll largely be focusing on the draft development consent order. in those, although not exclusively. And they're due on the 8th of May.
You turned away from the mic.
Oh, sorry, what?
Sorry, you said you would be concentrating on and then turned away from the microphone.
Did I?
Yeah. So sorry, I didn't catch it.
It was the draft development consent order.
Thank you.
Focusing on that, but not exclusively. The second thing we can confirm is that we will hold hearings in June, but they're likely to be 2 days rather than 3 days. We're thinking in terms of a single day for the draft development consent order and the compulsory acquisition matters. But we'll obviously confirm that a bit later. Mr. Hudson said, we will be producing a report on the implications for European sites, the Rees report. And let's see, we will also produce a schedule of proposed changes to the draft of a development consent order. That's scheduled for the 13th of July, but not our own version of the draft of a development consent order. We do believe it's important to leave the ownership of that document in the hands of the applicant until submission and close of the examination. So that's what we're doing there. Anything else from our side? Anything else that anyone in the room wants to raise before we close the hearing? Mr. Owen,
Robbie Owen, thank you, sir. Can I just seek a bit of clarification, if you're able to give it, in relation to the June hearings? We currently have the 26th of June being the Tuesday reserved for an issue-specific hearing on outstanding environmental planning policy and socioeconomic issues. On the Wednesday, the 27th, we got the morning reserved for a compulsory acquisition hearing and the afternoon reserved for an open floor hearing. And then on the 28th is currently reserved for the issue-specific hearing on the draft DCO itself. Did I understand you to say that you were thinking of sort of combining into one day, whether the Wednesday or the Thursday, the CA hearing and the hearing on the DCO?
That's right. We don't at this stage see the need for another open floor hearing. We've had no request for one, so we don't see the need to hold that one.
Thank you, sir. That's helpful. Would it be safe to assume that combined hearing might be on the Wednesday, the 27th, or
Tuesday and Wednesday, or Wednesday and Thursday? We haven't really thought that through. But are you making a pitch for Tuesday and Wednesday?
I think we probably are, yes.
We'll take that away then in that case, and yes, we'll bear that in mind. But yeah, it's most likely to be the 2 days, Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Any more from anyone else? In which case, it only remains for me then to formally close this issue-specific hearing on compulsory acquisition and related matters at 12:04. And thank you very much indeed for all your contributions.